Are you on dope?
Yes.
What kind?
Musical dope.
You get high?
Yes.
Off of what?
Music.
Are you on a trip or something?
Yes.
What kind of a trip?
Music.
How old are you?
I'm old in mind, but young in age.
This is Brianna Marie, and you're listening to Soul Discovery, a place run by passion and really dedicated to its music, artists, producers, and record labels, which makes it a unique place, but also a place where listeners come to really absorb themselves and can tap into their emotions and take themselves on a discovery of their own.
Hey, this is Wally Ali from Detroit, Michigan, and you're listening to Soul Discovery, uniting the past, present, and future for the legacy of our music.
I must surely be a wishing and a hoping to be free. Oh, but some say you can leave, but it's going to cost you. She said, yeah, you can leave, but it's going to cost you. Yeah.
Welcome to Soul Discovery. Wow, am I excited about this one. Oh, I've been chasing this guy for many a moon and many a year. and we've finally tracked him down. And just a taster of some of the people he's worked with: Love Smith, Patrice Rushen, Tina Marie, Marvin Gaye, Norman Connors, Rocky Robbins, Gladys Knight and the Pips. And that's just a taster. Wally Alley, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Mick. How are you doing, man?
Oh, wow. You are a legend. You know that, don't you?
I didn't know it until you told me, yeah.
It's nice when someone tells you you're a legend and you're still alive. That's the main
thing.
Yes,
sir, absolutely.
So we'll just talk about your history. Where were you brought up?
I was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
What was that like growing up?
Omaha was a good community. We had a community. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody's parents could whip you, so it was all good. The coach and the teacher and the janitor, everybody could whip you, so it was all good.
Okay. What was there any music in your house when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The blues. Matter of fact, my mother liked the blues. I learned about Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King and Albert King and all the guitarists, Freddie King, because they played it. Every Saturday they played it. She played it when she was cleaning up the house or she was in a bad mood, so she'd play it then.
It sounds like my dad used to play, when he was in a bad mood, he used to play certain records, so you knew not to go in the house.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
So, guitar, that's your main instrument, your guitar. How did that happen?
Believe it or not, we had a barber in our hometown, and he was an older guy. So he was so old, he would talk a little bit and he would cut a little bit. So that means all the children's Saturday was destroyed. Every 2 weeks, they had to get a haircut. We'd get in there about maybe 9 in the morning. We wouldn't get out till about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So a guy comes, Omaha was divided north and south, North Omaha and South Omaha. So a guy comes from over North Omaha, opens up a barbershop. He's doing Covada's haircuts. He cuts the children's hair in 30 minutes, we out, right? So all the children start going to him. And after that, the next 2 weeks I went, the guy had a brand new guitar, a Gibson Birdland, beautiful guitar, which would cost about $15,000 now. And I think it was about maybe $2,000 even back then. And so I see it and I head directly for it after I get out of the chair, knowing that he's going to tell me, "Don't you put your hands on that thing." And he never did. So I went right directly to it and played with it for a while, and then I was out. We had music at school, so music was my best subject. I played the bass fiddle. I did a whole lot of things, but I had one of those black song flutes that had about 8 notes on it. So one day I come into the barbershop, and I'm listening to the music while I'm waiting to get my hair cut, and I'm playing one of the intricate jazz songs on this black song flute. And he's amazed. He said, "How did you know how to do that?" And I said, "Do what?" I'm just playing what I hear, right? So he asked me, "Well, would you like to learn how to play guitar?" I said, "No, I want to be a saxophone player," right? So he says, "No, I can't teach you how to play the saxophone, but I can teach you how to play guitar." I said, "Well, I'm 10 years old. What do I got to do? What I need?" So it was history from there. And he had a challenge from day one, because when I first started playing, I took the guitar and turned it upside down. I'm left-handed. So he said, "Oh, my God, I got a challenge right here." So he taught me how to play it upside down. And then when my mother invested in me getting a nice guitar, he turned the strings around. So that means I almost had to learn all over again. But I come to find out later on in the years, it was fortunate that I learned that way.
Yeah, wow. The age of 9, you started doing gigs.
Age 11.
All right, I got that.
Yes, sir.
Right. Okay.
Yes, sir. 11, so, my first professional job, meaning that was the first time I got paid for doing it.
How did you get paid?
They had what they call floor shows, right? And you would perform your little song in about 5 minutes, not even that long, maybe 2 minutes. And the people would throw money on the floor. They'd throw, you know, like tips and stuff. They'd throw it all on the floor. And then after that, we pick it up. And I sometimes make $150, $200, you know. I was making more money then than I make now.
Wow. That was a lot of money. And then from that onwards, the age of 17, you arrived at Motown.
Yes, sir. The way I got out of Omaha was I was very creative. I sang all the time. I sang before I learned how to play. But the neighbor was coming and asked me, say, "Well, what song is this?" And I knew all the songs on the radio. And they would come, the ladies especially would ask me to come and sing it for them, and I would sing the songs. So one day I was talking
telling jokes, and we were talking about each other's mother. And the old men would come to my mother and say, because I was so creative, they couldn't out-talk me. So they told my mother they were going to kill me, right? They said, we're going to kill him if he keeps talking about our mother like that. So she worked at night, and her nerves were very bad. So she would get home at 5 o'clock. I'd get in the bed at 4:59. And I could never figure out how she knew I was smoking weed all night. And the way she knew it is because my eyes were red as cherries. So it really bugged her. So she said, listen, I got to put you somewhere where I know you're going to be safe. So she puts me in the training school. Now, mind you, all the children in the neighborhood that go to the training school, they're either car thieves, robbers, or whatever it is. And my mother puts me in the training school. So I'm really distraught. I was only there for about 6 months, but I'm really distraught because I'm embarrassed. I'm saying, man, all these cats came up here with robbing and stealing and stuff. My mama put me here, right? Anyway, it was the best thing she could have ever done for me because the neighborhood we lived in, it was just 2 blocks long, and it seemed like it took me forever to walk 2 blocks to get to the store. Well, out in the training school, the fields were wide. We were baling hay. We were digging potatoes and picking vegetables and stuff like that. And when I came back, 2 steps, I was at the store. So I said, listen, this is just too small for me. So I told my mother, I said, Mom, I'm leaving. So my 16th birthday would have been in 2 days. So she said, you can't go anywhere. You're only 16 years old. I said, listen, I got to go. So my mother had a duplex, and the children stayed downstairs, and her husband stayed upstairs. So I would go upstairs and clean up their room. So one day I go up there and I find $500 in a rubber band. It's rolled up in a rubber band. And I like to shoot pool. So I would stay in the pool hall all day. I go to the pool hall and the local blues guitar player comes in and says, listen, I have to sell my car. And I need $150. Well, I got $500. I flash it on him and tell him, listen, if you can beat me playing 9-ball, I'm trying to challenge myself. Because I know I can play, right? I play all day. So I'm challenging myself. And I'm saying, if you can beat me, I'll buy that car. He said, rack them up. So you rack them up. We're playing 9-ball. I run the table. And I'm doing it real quick and scratch on the 9-ball. Scratch means I lose. He doesn't say anything. He walks out the door. He gets all the stuff out of the trunk, and when I get outside, he has the key. And he says, okay. I said, well, look, this is not my money. He said, that's not my problem. Here's the key. So I get the key, and I got $350, and I got a car, and I need to find somewhere to get out of town because I can't go back home. I done took the money. I know I can't go back home. Anyway, I take the money. I call my friend, who's the organ player in our band, and he tells me, yeah, I have a girlfriend in Denver, Colorado. Denver's like 500 miles away from us. So we get in the car and we go. I don't call my mother for 2 months. I call back and she just slams the phone down. You know, you caused me so much trouble because I took that $500. But one thing about my mother, I could always talk to her once she cooled down. So when she cooled down, I'd explain to her what happened and she accepted it finally.
Yeah, son of a good mother.
Yeah, she was beautiful. Well, I could always talk to her, even though I would make her so angry, you know. But we could talk, you know.
So you went off to Colorado, Motown. How did that happen?
Played with a group called the Third World Descendants. And we were in Denver, Colorado. We were playing at a club called the KC Lounge. And it was 10 people in the band, and we were making $2 a week, right? So a local, but the band is smoking though. We tight. We had great arrangements, you know, great singers and great saxophone players. It was really nice. So a guy comes up from Colorado Springs who has a nightclub, and he hears about us, and he hears the band, and he takes us, say, okay, well, I have a club in Colorado Springs. If you all come down and play, I have a house for you. You can stay in, and you can eat at my restaurant. So we went from $2 a week to $85 a week apiece. Remember, it's 10 of us. Right. So we finally get situated. One day I'm coming to work and the drummer is having a shootout with the cook. So I said, man, these guys are really. So anyway, we just then at that particular point got management. So we had to go rush because the guy that owned the club came and said, you guys got to be out of town by sundown. right? So we send the musical director up to the Denver to get a car. We pull our money, we buy a car. He comes back with a station wagon, and all 10 of us get in the station wagon. We drive to California. So when we get to Cali, we have a manager, and they put us up in this nice hotel, and we eat up about $500 worth of food, and come to find out these managers have hot credit cards. So when the people when they find out, they put us out of the hotel. So we go from the Swank Hotel downtown Los Angeles to one of the sleazy motels up on the west side, right, called the Reno Hotel. It was sleazy where all the prostitutes and everybody hung out at. Anyway, so we stay there. We land another job with one of the with the guy who has a club in on Sunset Boulevard, 6666 Sunset Boulevard. The club is called the Citadel de Haiti, and the owner was Bernie Hamilton, the actor who acted as Starsky and Hutch.
Yep.
He was the owner, right? So we would see Tony Francioso. All those actors would come, and they would come and read when we take a break. So Bernie, we had the same situation. Bernie had a house we could stay in. We ate at the restaurant at his club, and we worked like six nights a week. So at the end of the Saturday, we would get paid. Bernie would stand at the door and take the money back for what we ate and what we had.
Oh, well.
So we're not making any money, but we're playing, right? It's during the time we have... Jimi Hendrix dies, right? So everybody goes up on Purple Haze. So we all go up, and then the band goes crazy. They jump off the singer jumps off the organ and smashes the horn player's horn. So that's the end of the band, right? So I'm still working at Bernie's Club because I'm cleaning up and trying to make some extra money. And 100 Proof Aged in Soul comes into to the club to rehearse. They needed a place to rehearse, and Bernie let them rehearse in his club. Now, this company was Holland, Dozier & Holland's company, a company called Invictus Records.
Yep.
Holland, Dozier & Holland was, they were the sponsor of these guys. So they needed a guitar player. So I auditioned. And there's this little Mexican kid by the name of Tommy Trujillo. He smokes me, man. He comes in and he runs, he plays circles around me. And I'm saying, man, I'm not going to get this job. And the only reason why they chose me because I was a black guy, right? It wasn't definitely about my skill. It was about that. And I know Tommy. Me and Tommy laughed about that all the time. But anyway, I go from there, and we're working with this group. So we go from the club, and now we're on our way to Detroit to do 10 days at the 20 Grand Club. So when we do 10 days, after the 10 days, Holland, Dozier & Holland fires all of us. Because of the, they fire us because all the singers are junkies, right? So we get fired in the club, the 20 Grand. It was a complex. It had the hotel. It had a bowling alley. It had a disco. It had the nightclub. And it also had a restaurant and a hotel. It had a restaurant. So I'm in the hotel eating, and Chuck Jackson's band comes in. And I don't even have a case on my guitar. The guitar's sitting on the wall, and I'm finished eating. I'm on my way out. They say, hey, do you play that? I say, yeah. They say, well, I want you to audition. We need a guitar player. So I go to the club, I audition. They like my playing, so they hire me. So, okay, I do another 10 days in the 20 Grand with Chuck this time, and I'm getting ready to go back to Omaha. They say, no, why don't you come on down to North Carolina with us? You know, I have an extra room in my house. This is the musical director. I have an extra room in my house. You can stay in the back room. I said, okay, fine. I go to North Carolina. We join the band, and the name of the band is The Funk Factory. As a matter of fact, Wilson Pickett got the song's name from our band. He called the song The Funk Factory. That's where he got the name. Fast forward, the drummer is in the band. He gets drafted, and he has to lead a band. That breaks the band up. So he stays for a year and gets out on some kind of technicality. He calls me one day and says, listen, I'm staff drummer for Motown now. I said, oh, no kidding. I said, well, listen, if you find anything, let me know. I'm on the first thing smoking, right? So a couple of months go by. I play with another group called the Persuaders. It's a thin line.
Oh, yeah, it's a thin line.
Yeah. So I work with them. We do a summer. About wintertime, I get a call. They say, listen, As a matter of fact, it is wintertime. It's about February. I get a call. They say, listen, your ticket is at the airport. We're going to pick you up at the airport, and we're going to be starting the band with Undisputed Truth. I said, fine. They pick me up. We stay in the band house. Now, in the band house is our band, and Wawa Watson is one of the members of the band house. But he leaves and goes, Billy Calvin, one of the singers in Undisputed Truth, is his girlfriend. So he goes to live with her, and then I take over his room in the band house. So we hang out, and that's how I started with Tell You the Truth.
You arrived, and Undisputed Truth, heavily involved in 1970 with Norman Whitfield. How was that at the moment? And because Motown were doing a lot of change in direction in their music at that time.
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, Norman it can be the one to be attributed for doing that changes, because he was the one that did Psychedelic Shack on the Temptations, and he produced the Temptations. He produced Edwin Starr. As a matter of fact, Berry Gordy was such a brilliant marketer. He, whenever he did a song, you know, remember he was only selling the records for $1 a piece, and you got 2 records for $1. Now you only pay $1, you only get 1 record. You know what I'm saying? You got side A and side B. Anyway, when Berry cut a song, he cut it on everybody. Undisputed Truth did Smiling Faces. Temptations did Smiling Faces. They did, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Temptations did it. Papa, Edwin Starr did it. All of them did it. And Berry would sell about 5 million copies because all of them sold over 1 million copies. So, but with Norman was such a wonderful manager. I'm not manager, but a boss. I would just say a boss. He paid us very well. We were working all the time, but we go on the road for about 4 months. And when we come off to, well, actually, went 4 months, about 2 months. And we come off the road, we go into the studio. So we get out of the studio, back on the road. So we had, it was just a wonderful whirlwind of time. Now, this is up to 1970. In 1970, I get to Motown, and then 1971, Berry moves the company to Los Angeles. But when I first get to do the first studio gig, we're doing Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Now, it was 8 guitar players on that session, right? And this is where I met Paul Reiser. Paul Reiser has this chart. It's so long, I got to have 2 guitar stands to put the 2 music stands to put the chart on. And I don't read any music at all. It's Japanese to me. I don't know what this stuff is. But if I could hear it, I knew I could play it, right? So I'm in there with the Funk Brothers, Earl Van Dyke, Eddie Willis, all these guys. And they're not rehearsing any music at all, because this is what they do every day. They're clowning. Eddie Bongo has a girly book of where his chart is supposed to be. He's looking at a girly book, and they just clowning and acting fool. And I know I'm finished, because I'm saying, as soon as the producer comes in, he's going to know I can't read this stuff, and I'm going to be out, right? So I'm nervous, and I'm waiting on him to come in, and Norman comes in, takes the chart, throws it on the floor, and says, play this right here. I said, thank God, because I was about to be out of here. So anyway, and I play what he said, matter of fact, don't even play that. Play what you feel. So I play what I feel, and my part is basically the the bass of the record of Papa Was a Rolling Stone. But on that record is 8 guitar players. You got Eddie Willis, Joe Messina, Robert White, Dennis Coffey, this boy named Paul Warren, myself, a guy named Robert Ward. Well, it was 8 of us on there anyway. So, and Eddie Willis, all he did was play the chinks. Chink, chink. That's all he did. And he comes to work with a briefcase. Like he's saying, my God. But his part is so important because that chink locks the track.
Yes.
So, but I'm saying it was such an amazing time. So the Funk Brothers didn't go to Los Angeles. They stayed in Detroit. We're thinking about doing a Funk Brothers 2 before everybody else dies. And, you know, all the guys that came from Detroit that came to Los Angeles. Hopefully we can do a Funk Brothers 2.
But let's have a listen to that chink, chink, chink.
Okay.
That day I'll always remember, yes I will, cause that was the day that my daddy died. Papa died when we were there young. I never got a chance to see him. I never heard nothing but bad things about him. Mama, I'm depending on you to tell me the truth. Looked up and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. What he left us was alone.
Hey, mama, is it true what they say that Papa never worked a day in his life?
Storefront preaching, talking about saving souls and all the time leeching,
dealing in dirt
and stealing in the name of the Lord.
Mama just looked up.
Papa was a rolling stone, yeah. Wherever he laid his hat.
My special guest on Soul Discovery, Wally Alley. Wally, that record has changed so many boundaries. Did you realise at the time, after the Temptation had done it, how important that record was going to be for the rest of the music industry?
We had no idea. We were just doing what it felt like in the moment. And, you know, like I said, it was a creative time. We were in what was called the pit, and they were doing construction. Half of the floor was dirt, and then it was drywall. You know, it wasn't even finished yet. We were still cutting records, you know. So it was a wonderful time.
And what was it like down in there? Were you in there? How many hours were you in there when you used to go in and on a daily process?
We would be there all day. It would be an all day thing because we were playing rhythm for everybody. You know, Stevie Wonder, whoever the artists were on Motown, we played the rhythm for them.
Okay, so, and you were working with Holland Dozier and Holland and Paul Reiser and Norman Whitfield. Who else was involved in that period with you at that time?
Yeah, actually, they had a lot of great writers, but those were the main ones. Mm. Holland Dozier and Holland Smokey, and even Barry was writing. Barry was writing things too. So, you know, those are the most important guys, and those are the ones that were in the studio the most. Self-contained, you know, and they had their little thing. But, yeah, those are the main guys.
But at that time, you were just playing guitar. You weren't doing any vocal work.
No, just guitar, playing guitar.
Nobody.
I didn't start doing vocal work until I started working with Chuck Jackson, and I was doing background vocals with him.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, were you ever credited for that on any of Chuck Jackson's stuff?
No. We didn't. I didn't really record with Chuck. We just did the live stuff. We just toured with him. I didn't record with him.
Right. Okay.
You're talking about a consummate performer, man. I learned so much about performance.
Yeah, but you are as well. Come on, he's a genius.
I appreciate that.
Yes. But what was the feeling like with the churn and the music that was going out across, were you realizing what was happening across the music coming across to Europe?
No, we didn't even know. We had no idea because we really didn't tour Europe. We mostly toured the United States. Like I was telling you about Barry being a great marketer, the Undisputed Truth was the weakest group in the company and the Jackson were the strongest. So we toured with the Jacksons.
That was the Jackson 5 at the time, yeah?
Yes, exactly. The Jackson 5, exactly what they were called then.
Okay.
And we toured with them, yes.
And that was groundbreaking then because they were just really starting to take off. They
yes.
were taking on the likes of the Osmonds, etc.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that was
and
the goal.
We did the world. We did the United States tour with them, and they went on to do the world tour.
Mm.
And a lot of things, what people don't realize, Joe Jackson is the one who sponsored the whole all those concerts, and he bought out all the houses around the world.
Wow, didn't know that. Mm.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right, let's take it. I'm going to go back now, move slightly forward, but I mean go back. We're going to listen to two tracks that were released on an album by Holland Dozier Holland that have got your vocals on. You're technically your first vocal recordings with them, as we're aware of, unless you know different. The album was called Yesterday, Today and Forever. And these two tracks, I'm going to play just two snippets. These are outstanding. Your vocals are incredible on here. Incredible.
I appreciate that. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Guest is Wally Alley. Wally, that second track we played, I Need Your Loving, that's got a massive cult following around the world on that track. It's very hard to obtain that album now, worth a lot of money. It's they released three tracks on the album by you, and far as I'm aware, period would that have been? Is that the first time that they put vocals down on a recording for you?
No, actually, yeah, actually for me, but actually that particular project, redoing all of Holland Dozier and Holland's catalog. That's why it's called Yesterday, Today, and Forever.
Yeah.
And the arranger on that is McKinley Jackson.
He is,
McKinley
yeah.
is the ball. Superb, man. It was just fantastic. Yes, those are the ones that I did. And on the Almost There track, they asked me to do it, and I came in. That was one take. We did one take.
Well, that's unbelievable, because that is just one of the outstanding tracks of all time, and you did that in one take. That's
one take, and I actually wanted to do it again, but Eddie Holland wouldn't let me. I mean, not Eddie, Brian Holland wouldn't let me.
Right,
I
okay.
Said, no, that's
it. You moved on. You moved then. Why did you move away from the Motown? Because in 1974, you joined a group called The New Creation.
Yeah, actually, from 1972, I joined the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
Yeah, and I became a Muslim, and I stopped playing music altogether for those 2 years. I went into the temple and started selling Muhammad Speaks newspapers, and matter of fact, I worked at one of the restaurants as a fry cook. So for the first 2 years, I worked there, and I had some friends that came. They were musicians. We finally joined each other and worked together for about 30 years in a band. And the guy told me, said, "How do you play in Motown? You was cooking my fish."
Right.
And I had a friend that he was a blues singer. His name was Little Jimmy Sly. And he came into the restaurant one day and said, "Didn't you work for Motown before?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You need to get your ass back over there."
So where did this come from, the New Creation? Where did that happen? That
happened. The New Creation was a group that we created. It was a singing group. It was three of us. We sang along with the, I just accompanied them with the guitar. So we sang, and we actually wrote songs for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We were on our way to Chicago to sing for him, and he had passed that year in 1975. And that was the end of our group for New Creations. But we were on our way to sing for him, yeah.
But you're at that time, before you were Wally Alley, your name was William Cooper.
William Cooper, Billy Cooper, yeah. Yeah,
Billy. Yeah.
Yes, sir,
I'll
yes.
call you Billy, yeah. a good cowboy name.
Exactly.
Well, let's play this song, because I want to know all about these lyrics, because the fisherman's song. Let's have a little snippet.
Fish song, yes.
That brother,
I saw some beautiful brothers the other day, and they was looking good.
Oh yeah, what was they doing?
They was going all through the neighborhood selling Viking H&G fish and making a happy sound.
Oh yeah,
listen.
We're in your neighborhood with your fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah. We're in your neighborhood with your fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah. We're in your neighborhood fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah. We're in your neighborhood with your fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah.
At last we've got it. We've got one good fish of our own.
Fish of our own.
At last we've got it.
Got
good
it.
Fish of our own.
Creation, the fish song, and while we're cutting the records short, I'm afraid I do apologize, but you'll hear them on my show full entirety later on, but we got so much to squeeze in. So that was roughly about 1974. So how did that record actually come? Why that them lyrics to that song?
What happened with the record is we finally, in the Nation of Islam, we started doing business with Peru, and Peru was shipping fish to us, and we were providing it to the people in the neighborhood. As a matter of fact, we had such a trust to the people in the neighborhood, we sold the fish actually before we got it, and the people were really impressed with the Nation of Islam at that particular time.
And the arranger on that particular song was H.B. Barnum, who was the musical director for Aretha Franklin also.
Yeah, and well, that takes you into a busy period then, because everybody's after you, and you go touring with Marvin Gaye in 78.
Yes, sir.
What was that like?
It was excellent. As a matter of fact, it was excellent and challenging at the same time, because the way I got the job was Marvin found his wife in the bed with the guitar player. So that's how I got the job. So anyway, I fly from Los Angeles and I get to Atlanta, where we're supposed to be staying. And everybody's angry. All the whole band, we got 13 pieces in the band. Everybody's angry. And I said, "What's? Why are you so angry? Oh, we haven't gotten paid in 2 weeks." Now I have, at this time, I got three children, right? I have three children and I'm coming to Atlanta and they're talking about they didn't get any money. So I'm really upset until the manager comes in. And when the manager comes in, he tells them, and they talk about everything. They talk about equipment. They talk about uniforms. They talk about everything. The man is getting ready to walk out the door. And I say, "Hey, what about the money?" And the guy said, "Oh, the money." Now, remember, we got 13 pieces in the band and we're making $2,000 a week. So that's 26 grand he can walk out with. And don't have to answer to it for the next 2 weeks. He can do whatever he wants, right?
Yep.
So actually, I was a game changer, and I always have been this way. And I really, it's not something that I really was trying to do, but I wound up being the guy. So anyway, the guy tells him, "Oh, Marvin says that he's going to pay you every Tuesday. And if he doesn't pay you every Tuesday, he'll give you a 5% surcharge every day he's late." Now, the guy was going to walk out. He wasn't going to say this until we stuck. And sure enough, Marvin was a great, great, great boss, man. He paid us bonuses on Christmas and stuff and you know, bought things for the children and all that. He's a very, very good man. He was just in a problem at the time, but it was beautiful. Yeah, I worked with Aretha, Marvin Gaye, and Patrice Rushen at the same time. From 1977 to 1980, and all the dates never conflicted. When I got through with one, I was on the tour with another one. When I came after that, I got a call with another one. And I did actually 30 days with Patrice straight in a row, and the dates never conflicted.
Wow. And you've got to tell me the story about Marvin Gaye and the bus.
Marvin Gaye was a fantastic leader. Brilliant man, right? One day, we get to the airport. We were in Louisiana. We flew to Louisiana. And there was no limos. So we called Marvin and say, "Marvin, there's no limos." He said, "That's okay. I'll take care of it." 30 minutes later, here comes three limos. He called a funeral home and got the limos for the funeral. We had limos, though. Don't get it twisted. We had limos, right?
Yeah, as long as there was nothing in the limo.
You understand? Like, right. It wasn't a hearse. It was a limo. But anyway, we were on. We were in Atlanta for, I think it was Morris Brown College. We were playing Morris Brown. And the concert started at 8 o'clock, and Marvin hadn't gotten his money. So we had about 10 false starts. And every time we got ready to start, that meant Marvin was getting his money. Then they said, "No, he didn't get his money." So we start the concert about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we end about 4:30. So they say, "Okay, when you get to the hotel, do not go to sleep because we're leaving at 6 o'clock. I tried my best to stay up. I couldn't stay up, man. Shoot, they were 200 miles down the road when they found out I wasn't on the bus. And they came back. They were so upset. I said, "Listen, man, I tried."
You must have been very important for them to turn.
Man, I evidently, because I just knew they weren't coming back. I said, "Shit, I missed it." That was 7 o'clock, and they got back about 8 o'clock and came and got me.
Right. So that period of touring, were you recording through that period?
We were recording and touring. We was in the studio. This was during the time when Marvin was having a problem with his wife. Mm-hmm. We recorded "Here, My Dear."
Yeah,
we recorded a whole lot of things in the studio with Marvin. Marvin had his own studio on Sunset Boulevard, and so yeah, we work with, you know, we recorded. I was also recording with Patrice.
Then La Mondozia came along and formed a group in 1980 on Wheels Records. Let's listen to the two tracks first, because just incredible.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. the same hungry way. You don't have to worry, I'm not just out for one night of fun. I can never lead you on. I take your love, take your love and run.
Hey, this is Wally Ali from Detroit, Michigan, and you're listening to Soul Discovery.
Soul Discovery, and my special guest is Wally Ali, and we're listening to In the Background Zingara. The first track you heard was For All My Life, I'm Serious, lead vocals Wally Ali on there, and you're listening to James Ingram. That was formed and arranged, and every song was done by Lamont Dozier on Real Records. There was only ever one album. What happened?
What happened was the company ran out of money. We had a backer who was a guy from, I think he was from Russia, and they just ran out of money. But the way I got the job was I put together my own showcase, and I invited record company people to come and sign me, right? And when I finished the showcase, the people from Wheel Records stood up and said, "We'll sign you right now." But when I got there, the record was almost finished. James Ingram had already did most of the tracks, and there was only two tracks left. That song, All of My Life, and I'm Serious, and I did another song called Gypsy Heart.
Yeah, Gypsy Heart, which is an incredible track as well. Yeah,
they're two different. And remember, I'm Muslim now, and the other one is talking about me being a playboy, and this one was talking about being a lover.
Yeah, got you.
So I was praying that that Gypsy Heart didn't ever come out, but it was an interesting story. Interesting story about the record. At that particular time, James Ingram got sold. He started working with Quincy, and Quincy just really took him away from Lamont, right? And Lamont was so angry until he didn't put his name on the album. He didn't put James' name on the album, right? So it was just Zingara. He never gave James credit. So one day I'm in Philadelphia listening to the radio, and the guys were listening, and that song, Love's Calling, went to number 30 without any promotion at all. It's such a great song, right? So anyway, I'm in Philly, and the guy's talking on the radio. They said, "Well, we don't see." He said, "It sounds like James Ingram, but his name is not on the album." I don't understand that. So the other guy said, "Well, yeah, you know, James became a Muslim, and he changed his name to Wally Ali."
That's why your name is very hard to find.
Exactly.
And that's crazy, why you're a very hard guy to track down on certain tracks. It's unbelievable. You were really, really working hard at this time. You had worked with Love Smith, Tina Marie, Rick James, Flakes, Norman Connors, Gladys Knight. You were writing for Gladys as well. Richard Popcorn Wiley you were working for. Did you work with Marvin Yancey at the time?
I work with Marvin, yeah. We work with Marvin. We worked with, you know, we were just in the studio doing things. I don't know whether they gave me credit for it, but we were there. And most of the things I did was overdub stuff anyway, so I never was, like, in the studio that long. I didn't want to stay in the studio all the time.
That period, did you work with Paul Reiser again?
We work with Paul. You know, we work with Paul. As a matter of fact, Paul is doing a piece that we're doing right now. A brother, a friend of mine out of Ethiopia, is doing a song, and Paul is doing the arrangement for that.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you one or two things as well. You worked with Rocky Robbins on his album. There was a lead vocalist on that album, background vocalist Sam Dees. Did you ever work with Sam on his own in any of his recordings?
I worked with Sam because I did recording with Larry Graham, and I would do sessions with Larry. And Sam was one of the writers for Larry Graham. As a matter of fact, it's closet, but I always say that One in a Million they stole from me, because I would be in the studio playing around on the piano and I was experimenting with those chords. Then all of a sudden I hear One in a Million come out. I said, they stole my song.
I actually met Larry Graham once. I was on a dance floor in the UK, okay. And I got this big, big, big dude come next to me, and I thought he was hustling me. And he's standing there with a hat on, and he's looking at me, and he's copying me. And he comes walking over to me, says, "Man, you can dance." And I says, "Who are you?" He says, "My name's Larry Graham." So I bought him a drink. Now, you've got to tell me, one of the greatest engineers and one of the people that were behind most of the stuff that happened in that golden period through the 80s, or even before that, but he come to fruition in the 80s, Barney Perkins. What did you? I know you worked with him. You've done a lot of work with him, but was there anything that we don't know about?
Believe it or not, Barney was the one that showed me how to play guitar on the tracks, because he said, because when I first came into the studio, I'll be playing everything. I'm doing my own stuff, I'm saying. He said, "Man, you putting everything but the kitchen sink in there." He says, "Cut it out, man." I said, "Okay." So he taught me how to space it and things like that. And Barney was big and heavy. And when the Japanese came over, they had a studio for Yamaha came over. Yamaha had a studio, and Barney worked at the studio. As a matter of fact, they used to have the track assignments on the mixing board up at the top, and they designed it where Barney could sit down and just dial the tracks, because they put a dialer on there where he could just turn the dial, you know, because he was so heavy he couldn't get up and down. But he was an amazing, amazing guy, you know. Studio time was costing $150 an hour back then for us, even us, you know. So Barney would give me a break, you know, and Barney, he lived in Beverly Hills, you know. So he said, "I have a Rolls Royce," he said, "and every time I try to go past a certain street to go to the ghetto to get my barbecue, my car starts sputtering." So he said, he doesn't go to the ghetto at all. He sends somebody to get by. But he was an amazing guy, an amazing guy. We had such beautiful fun.
D-West Records, that is. Was that your first recording on that label?
Yes, sir. That was my label.
Okay, and you had the Water Sisters on that, on the background vocals.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow. And was Barney part of that?
Barney was. He mixed this stuff for us. You
yeah,
know?
Wow.
Yeah, Barney okay. mixed it.
You can tell that. You can tell that it's the production's so tight. It's brilliant. Mm. Absolutely brilliant. So D Records, you went on to record other tracks as well. Let the World Come Together, which we'll play a snippet of it in a minute. And Man Gets What He Strives For. Absolutely incredible tunes. And was that mixed by Barney Perkins as well at the time?
Yes, sir. Yeah, yeah. Well, during the time, like I said, he gave us a break, so we did all that stuff in one session, you know.
Okay, and what's the D yeah. for in West?
D means like the Jamaicans would say the, but it's like D, the West, the West.
Right, got you. Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. Soul Discovery, and you're listening to the incredible vocals of Wally Alley. Wally, that track, Let the World Come Together, it's incredible, that track. Who's the background vocalist on that?
Actually, I'm using a girl by the name of Lyrica. Her name is Lyrica.
Wow.
She's a R&B singer, and another girl named Phyllis Battle, and myself, us three, we sing on this.
Yeah, and your vocals on that Man Gets What He Strives For, so powerful. That's an incredible record, that is. And that was from D West Records in about 1988, yes?
Yes, sir.
What are you up to now? What's happening with you?
I have a band called The Biggest Little Band in Town, and I've been working back and forth in Boston and Atlanta. So, you know, and just working with different musicians. We're working on a piece now that I'm putting a proposal together to do a tribute to Ray Charles. And we're going to do it at the Boston Symphony Hall and use a full orchestra for that particular piece. And if it works out okay, we're going to bring it around the world. So,
wow. You live in Boston now, yes?
Yes, sir.
You're not Irish?
Irish. You're Irish, right?
Yep. I've got a lot of relations in Boston.
Absolutely. That's excellent.
Yeah.
You know, the Irish, we share a history as people, African-American and Irish, we share a history.
Yeah. Some of it not good, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah. That's history for you.
You know, we were both.
You recorded a fantastic record, a wedding song. It's incredible. Shall we listen to it? Because I don't think many people have heard this, you know. I really don't.
No, it's new. It's new, yeah.
But let's have a listen to it, because okay. I just think the second half of this record is incredible. So we will hear not all of it, but some of it. Okay.
Darling, after much contemplation and deep meditation, we find we have so much in common. In fact, we find that our interests align. And I can see beyond a shadow of a doubt, a love like ours don't come by chance. So as we prepare to take our wedding vows, let me simply say, it's our wedding day. It's a blessing just to feel this way. All our family and friends will gather here to see us join together, dear. And as we prepare, no more reason to be in despair. The journey began as two and now we're one. Place our life before Allah out in the sun. A light for all to see. A life for you. It starts with two, then it grows into a life of love and trust. A life that's filled with our unyielding hope. In God's unyielding rope, my dear, our love is true, me and you, oh baby, the road is clear, my dear, there will be challenges from far and near, our ideas will be our children, girl, they have to grow into the plan that God designed, dear, you should know. There's no way that we can lose. This plan's divine. Now it's time for us to pour the wine. The wine with no headiness, our path is clear. Oh, baby, 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 there's no fear for us, my dear. Our life with you, it starts with two. Then it grows into a life of love and trust. A life that's filled with unyielding hope. In God's unyielding road. Oh dear, my love, our love is true. Me and you, oh.
Absolute perfection. Yeah. I'll have to get married again. To the same lady, though.
Yeah, that'll work.
Wow. You're going to be in demand for that record, I'll tell you. Wow.
I hope so, man. I hope so.
Robbie Love says hello to you.
Oh, yeah. Tell my girl I love her, man. That's my girl.
Is she going to be working with you?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you do any work with her mom?
I did. When I came to Los Angeles, her mom was one of the biggest singers around, yeah. And she was gracious enough to hire me to play with her, and we played behind her a lot.
Did you? That's interesting. I'll have to ask you off air about that.
Yes, sir.
Because she put some wonderful music out as well.
Yes.
So
yes.
Robbie's having a good time, and hopefully you two guys get together and get some work out there. That'll be great.
Sounds good. We appreciate it, man. Yeah. You're doing the interview too. Thank you very much.
No, Wally, it's an absolute pleasure, and we'll keep everybody in touch with you from now on. You don't disappear again. You can...
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
keep us updated with what's going on and anything you can think of in the past, which people are very interested in, who you work with and what tracks you've sung on, because there must be some more in the vault somewhere. We'd be very interested in hearing again.
Sounds good, Mick. I most certainly will.
Take care, mate. You take care. Brother.
God bless. Take care.
As I see a strong example, the Lipton Chinese. I want you to help him, won't you please help to guide him right? Crying, running through the streets, trying to hide himself from this awesome defeat. Yeah, he kicked his brother, knocking down in the street. Yet he don't think he's won the fight. And it wants to be found. The Lipton bar keeps coming around.
It keeps coming.
It keeps on coming around.
It keeps coming.
The Lipton bar keeps coming around.
It keeps coming around.
And in his heart, I believe it wants to be found. Oh. The Lipton boy sees up the little boy sees down. Nothing concrete can it find. The knowledge that's been given to him is a burden on his mind. The Creator, man must put his trust. The children of our care, the burden lies on us. Lost is the way for the children today, because of knowledge has been kept away. But yet this little boy, he keeps on coming around.